It's very lovely to be back amongst you all once again. It's so many familiar faces. I was pondering, as usual, what to talk about tonight, and then just seeing so many people that I know. Was Renata and Diana and Dennis. Anne-Marie, Kundanya, Diana. Yeah, I could go through the whole list, but so many of you, and also having been away in our winter retreat for 3 months, and the gathering here being taken care of by Mary Orr and Gil Fonstel and Venerable Hung Shua, who's the abbot of this monastery. Having been away for this time, not seeing you since. Beginning of December, what came to mind was just, or what sprang up really, was just the quality of community, of sangha, and that, what a lovely thing that is, what a beautiful quality. And as years go by and we all kind of get a bit greyer on top and thinner on top, and our joints get a bit more creaky, and as a community grows together and grows old together and develops together, then along with that the quality of spiritual community, spiritual friendship as the kind of binding agent is a very beautiful and important, wonderful quality. So it came to mind to just talk about that a little bit this evening. What that might mean, and how we go about developing, cultivating that. In the as I was saying a little bit earlier, there's a internal and external aspects to the quality of sangha. So externally, we might think of it as my Buddhist group, the community of people that I join up with. But there's a bit more to it than that. In the traditional verses that we do in paying respects to the sangha, then the phrase in the chanting goes. Taking refuge in Sangha, those who have practiced well, those who have practiced directly, those who have practiced insightfully, those who are accomplished in the practice. That is the four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings. And that sometimes people blink a little bit, the four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings, well, who are they? And what this is referring to is that those beings at the different stages, the four stages of liberation, the four stages of enlightenment. So that taking refuge in Sangha is, on an external level, is most essentially and powerfully drawing close to those who practice well, those who practice directly, those who practice insightfully, those who are accomplished, which means drawing close to other people who embody spiritual qualities. So whether they happen to be part of your Buddhist group or not, or wherever they spring up from, that refuge in Sangha is like seeing the value of and drawing close to good people, people who are say, committing their hearts to truth, to kindness, to unselfishness, to wisdom, and that this quality of drawing close does have an effect upon us. We are very much social beings. We are affected by those that we live with, and it's not just a matter of those who we happen to kind of share our houses with, or who we work with, or who we belong to the same groups with, But it's almost, you know, we live on many different levels nowadays, so that we don't just live on a physical level, a lot of us live on a kind of media level as well. So, like, those who you live with, it also includes, you know, those beings that come off the pages of the newspapers and the magazines, those beings that come off the through the airwaves at you, through the TV or the movies or the computer screen. That these are all, you know, people that you're sharing your life with, right? That some of us are kind of less physically located than others. They're kind of a bit more spread out through the universe. But what this means is that we acknowledge the effect that we have, that others have upon us, and what we put into our mind and what we surround ourselves with, so that by taking refuge in Sangha, there's an element there of not only trying to spend time with noble friends, good friends, and people who have good spiritual values, but also trying to find ways of living and things that we expose our minds to, which support spiritual practice. And we can all see the effects of when we're impinged upon by images or ideas or noises and things which are decidedly unspiritual, then immediately there's this kind of there's a change of mood within us. Just today, I'm reminded that we were watching some films. The house where we were staying in San Francisco, and there were these series of films that I'd heard much of over the last number of years. These are Kayana Scutzi and Paola Scutzi and Baraka. And so we just got to finished watching Paola Scutzi, which is it's a Hopi word. These are all films which have no dialogue, there are no actors in them, they're just probably many of you are familiar with these. They're made by Godfrey Reggio and Ronald Frick is the cameraman, is that right? Ron Frick is the cameraman. Anyway, there's images of the world, people and different environments and such around the world, and they basically speaking of the degeneration of the planet and the culture by the influence of materialism and greed from the first world. Anyway, these are very, very kind of beautifully filmed very powerful and very, very sensitive, very spiritual films in their own right. And so, you know, that moment when the film comes to an end and then the tape gets rewound, suddenly going from these very potent and still images and no human voices for quite some time, just this Philip Glass music, and watching these very reflective images, suddenly the film finishes and then there's American afternoon TV. And boy, was that a shock. Glaring colors and these weird voices that American presenters speak in in the adverts and kind of news pieces, and this kind of strange kind of media energy kind of bombarding the mind. So it was like I was quite happy to sit for a couple of hours watching the film, but then like 3 minutes of regular TV and it was something started freezing up. So the refuge in Sangha on this external level is just recognizing how the effect that we have, that has upon us, of the people that are around us, the influences around us, the living situation that we have, that has a powerful effect. And the Buddha points out that by drawing close to by drawing close to the wise, then it's not like you soak up wisdom, but it reminds you, it awakens in you the qualities of wisdom that you have. It reminds you, oh, I really love this stuff. Or when there's a quiet moment, it's like, oh, right, peace. Wow, this is nice. I like peace, don't I? Yeah. Oh, I forgot that, right. Oh yeah, I knew there was something. And so in another of the Buddha's teachings, in the Mangala Sutta, the discourse on blessings, the highest blessings, where the Buddha is approached and asked, what are the greatest blessings in the world? What are the most the greatest blessings for beings, for living beings? And the first thing the Buddha says is to associate with the wise and not to associate with fools. This is the highest blessing. So I'm not saying this in order for you to get sort of anxious and fussy about who's sharing the restaurant with you, or or getting kind of too fanatical, but just seeing how we are affected, and by when we do have choices, and we can figure out, we can decide how we spend our time, where we put ourselves, what situations do we seek out. Seeing that by drawing close to the wise, then this makes life a lot easier for us. We're not creating complication and disturbance, difficulty. The mind is not drawn into just kind of wasteful or secondary or kind of pointless pursuits and activity. Because also as human beings, we tend to we want to be in accord with the people that we're with, and I certainly experience this a great deal. Probably one of the reasons why I'm in a monastery is that I've found that through my life I'd be extremely affected by the groups of people that I was with, and that the primary thing would always be that I wanted to kind of harmonize with those around me. So if I was with an academic crowd, if I was in the university, then I'd be the kind of brilliant academic and try and say clever things and come up with interesting quotations all the time. And then if I was with a kind of sort of hippie anarchist crowd, then I'd have to be sort of as colorfully dressed and as chemically altered as everyone else, otherwise, hey, you're not in the game, Or if I was with the I had a very strange upbringing. If I was with the horse riding, hunting, and shooting, fishing set, which I was, I grew up on in the countryside in England, in a farm, and so part of my life was with the hunting, shooting, fishing crowd. Green Wellington boots. So they probably wouldn't mean much in your country. There's a sort of uniform that is worn, tweed jackets and green Wellington boots. It's the sort of standard, in a Land Rover. Standard equipment for the average rural type. And so I would hang out and drink gin and tonic and and discuss horses, with that crowd. But I could see that the thing that was always overriding effect was wanting to empathize with the people around me, whatever medium was present, that's what I would use. So by the time I was 21, I realized if I carry on with this, I'm going to end up with a really schizophrenic life. This is heading towards a multiple personality disorder. But it was interesting when I reflect, well, isn't this strange? How come, I'm such a chameleon? Then I could see, well, actually, I didn't really want to say be all these different characters, but what I want is to when I'm with another person is to say, yeah, you and I belong with each other. We are part of the same thing, and my affirmation of your way or your style or your character is my way of say manifesting that unity. So in this respect, we can find ourselves fitting in or playing along with people or attitudes or groups that are really not doing us much good, but because that happens to be the crowd that we work with, or the crowd that's in our family, or the crowd that that, you know, is there on the board with me, then it's like, well, that's the language they talk, that's the game they play, so I guess I better do it too. So to consider, you know, what effect does that have? You know, sometimes it's expedient to go along with it. Sometimes it's the absolutely the right thing to do. Other times, you know, it's like, well, why do I do this? Couldn't I do it some other way? Is there some other manner that I could operate in that would not be so, say, deluding, or take me to kind of unpleasant places, or into places where I, you know, regret the things that I say, or regret kind of playing along or supporting attitudes that are not helpful to me, not helpful to others. This comes up a lot when people say, well, nobody at work knows that I'm a Buddhist. You know, I never say that to anyone because I don't want to put them off, because they'll think I'm a Buddhist. And one guy in England I knew actually literally used to meditate in the closet at work. He was literally a closet Buddhist. He would go and sit in the broom cupboard and meditate in his lunch break so that people wouldn't, you know, see him meditating, because he was afraid of what effect that might have. And I said to him, do you think that it might actually be interesting or inspiring to the people that you work with that you're a Buddhist? And he said, what? You know, and the English tend to be prone to thinking that any sort of any foible that they have has to be sort of excused. We have to apologize for it, or assume that it's going to put other people off. But I said, no, maybe that's the case. And so sometimes it is much more useful, rather than feeling like one has to just play along with the system, of saying, you know, I'm not going to take part in this, or, well, I'm just going to let them know that I do meditate, or I don't want to eat meat at sort of group lunches, or I don't want to drink with everyone. One of our friends developed this technique when he was a monk in Thailand for a number of years. When he came back to the States, people kept offering him drinks, while he's always, you know, going out with friends, and so he didn't want to drink at all. And so he thought, well, how can I get around this? Because when he'd say to people, well, I don't drink, then that would start a whole argument, you know, become a whole big issue. So then he thought, oh, this is terrible. Well, what can I do? And then he developed this technique, which he said, it's not lying. It's not lying. It's just allowing a mistake to be believed in. So he'd say, when someone would say, would you like a drink? He'd say, my liver. He wouldn't say, I have an illness with my liver. He'd just say, my liver. Like, oh, okay, fine. Okay, orange juice? Or? So I think he still has a bit of doubt about how legal that one was. But another word for say, refuge in Sangha, or the Sangha refuge, is a very close meaning. Is the Pali word is Kalyanamita. Kalyanamita. And that, maybe some of you are familiar with that. Kalyana means beautiful or good, the wholesome. And Mita means friend. And there's a very famous exchange that I've probably quoted to you here numbers of times before, but is one of the most well-known passages from the scriptures, where it starts off with a little argument between Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, and another monk. And they get into a debate. Well, maybe debate is a better word than argument. But so this the monk that Ananda is talking with is a real kind of hardcore meditator. He's a sort of real, you know, get out there and fight the defilements and meditate, you know, and go off, you know, be alone in the mountains, hide yourself away, meditate till you break through to enlightenment. And this is the most important thing. This is the sole purpose of the holy life. This is the method. This is the essential thing. And then Ananda, who also has a reputation and comes as a bit of a softy, and is a sort of nice guy, he's the sort of conciliator, mediator, sort of arranger of appointments for the Buddha, and he's always trying to kind of keep everyone happy and sort of looked after, and is very sociable, and was criticized for being so sociable. But anyway, he heard this monk talking about how meditation and solitary practice was the all and everything. And then Ananda said, well, you know, I think that spiritual friendship is half of the holy life, Kalyanamita. Meaning the companionship of people that you practice with, the other monks and nuns and the lay community who are the kind of committed practitioners of the way. And your fellowship with them, the support from them, these are equally important. And so they go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and finally they say, okay, let's take this to the master. You know, they do it three times. You know, Buddhists always do things three times. So after the third back and forth, they go off to the Buddha. And then the Buddha famously, after Ananda recounts the entire discussion, and then the Buddha famously replies, not so, Ananda, not so. Spiritual friendship is not half of the holy life. It is the whole of the holy life. And so Ananda, wow, oh, okay, you know. And so, not that he stuck his tongue out at the other monk or anything, so, yeah, but one could feel a certain sort of, maybe a flush of pleasure that, hey, I got one right. You know, he scolded me, but I was on the right side of the argument. But then what the Buddha does, and oftentimes people, this is quoted in the context of talking about spiritual companionship and of the idea of support by your fellow practitioners and helping each other and bonding together and supporting each other's efforts in spiritual practice. And that's how the Buddha begins his response, saying, indeed, this is very important, this is crucial. But then he flips it around. And he changes the meaning. The Buddha was very fond of word plays. And so he flips the meaning around. And so rather than friendship, which is spiritual, rather than friendship, which is just kind of social or unspiritual, he flips it around to being friendship with the spiritual, with the lovely, like sort of lovely with a capital L, or friendship with the good, friendship with the beautiful, capital B. And so then what that means is that on the external level, he praises the quality of sangha, of spiritual communion, of community, as being of the most importance, of primary importance. But internally, then he uses the same word to praise that affiliation with the lovely, which means like a realization of the good, of the ultimate reality of the Dhamma, like that, and he uses exactly the same language to say, you know, this is the most important, this is the most central thing, and that these two do not kind of occlude each other, that wholehearted commitment to your companions and friends and concern for others around you is the external aspect, and the internal aspect where that friendship, where its source is in that realization of truth, that realization of the good, committing the heart to the good, to that quality. So this is a lovely way I find of representing these two dimensions of the practice, that actually the work of enlightenment, of liberation of the heart, that manifests itself externally. It is, you know, the most important thing, but it manifests itself externally with a very wholehearted commitment to one's relationship with other beings and to that bonding with others on a spiritual level, relating to others, those that we know, those that we don't know, those that are near, those that are far, or whatever nature, bonding with them on a level of spirituality. I guess one of the things that's also very significant in this is, you know, I can talk about this, and you can listen to it, and if I've kind of articulated it reasonably, then you might be thinking, yeah, right. But then Buddhism is not just a yeah, right religion. It's also a, well, how do I do it religion. How do I get there? So it's not just a matter of idealism, having a beautiful ideal or a clear ideal, but it's a matter of, well, why don't I experience that? Okay, I can see that's true, so how do I get there? Or what's in the way? And so it's helpful to consider that. And what is it that stops that from being apparent to us or realized within us? And primarily, what the problem is, I think, for all of us, essentially, we kind of color it in different ways, but essentially what stands in the way of one's wholehearted appreciation of others is really what sort of was, demonstrated in those films I was talking about on a very grand external level, which is the selfishness. You know, more for me. Me first. What I want, what I think, what I like. You know, those particular films kind of representing the results of greed, of self-centeredness. You know, the self-centeredness of the first world and the dominant, the kind of white materialistic dominant culture that has sort of taken over the planet in so many ways. And as the kind of cultural, dominant cultural force. But on a personal level, you know, isn't this what gets in the way? Is that whenever the mind is taken up with me, with what I think, what I feel, my problems, my plans, my talents, you know, my issues, it's just that's the kind of occluding presence. That's what, say, blocks the heart from this quality of kalyanamitta, of spiritual, of like that sense of affinity, a true quality of sangha. You know, when you look at it, you know, objectively a little, I mean, it's kind of obvious. If you're obsessed with this one, how can you recognize your connection to everyone else? You know, it's the kind of obvious relationship. That if this one has got the most important sets of feelings in the world, if what I think and what I feel and my perceptions are the most significance, then how can I possibly appreciate the feelings and needs and experiences of everyone around me to a similar extent? It's impossible. You know, it's just the mathematics of it doesn't work. You know, if all the attention and concern is going here, how can it go everywhere else as well? So that the principal work of spiritual practice is really noticing this feeling of the quality of self, the quality of I and me and mine, and how it manifests, how it takes shape. And sometimes we think of self-concern kind of manifesting in ways that are very obviously kind of egotistical or conceited, that have it, you know, some kind of really clear kind of arrogant or vividly selfish quality to them. But oftentimes it's very, very subtle, and it can almost seem sort of very reasonable. You know, I have to deal with my problems. You know, this is my opinion. It might be a very good opinion. It might be, this is my work. This is my family. This is my body. These are kind of oftentimes very inarguable, simple, straightforward issues that you wouldn't think of as being selfish. Yeah. We just don't hold it in our consciousness in that way. But yet, it's still that unconsciously and subtly, the mind gives extra value over and over and over again to my world, to what I feel, to what I think, to what I experience, to what I do. And it's not, this is not a kind of an evil thing or some kind of terrible corruption, but it's just our kind of human habit that we're all born into. And so that as we develop meditation, then we're kind of peeling through layer after layer after layer of the qualities of self-concern, self-centeredness. And slowly, and the more that we do that, the more that the layers peel off, the more we get to the kind of the very subtle levels, then accordingly, as the layers fall off, then we find ourselves experiencing this quality of sangha. We find ourselves, the less concerned I am about me, the more connected I am to you. Because in fact, we're all totally connected already, but it's not like you're creating a new connection. It's already there, but it's covered up, it's obstructed by the kind of fog of self-concern. I mean, again, it's just kind of obvious if you think of it in those terms. And that we're kind of discovering the natural relatedness that is already, has always been there. But the power of self-centeredness wipes that out. During this retreat at Abhayagiri, I had a couple of very fairly simple but significant insights around these kind of themes, one of which is sort of phrases itself in the somewhat in the language of Master Xuanhua, who is the abbot of the community who of which this is one of the monasteries. And it was a very simple realization, because I noticed that a lot of the time when I practice meditation, what I use little phrases to kind of steer the attention or to sort of balance things out, and just using little sort of reflective motifs. So I would use a phrase like something like opening the heart to the way things are, or opening the heart to the Dhamma, or allow the heart to rest in the knowing its own nature. And I would find that when I just would use a little phrase like that, just to say, you know, opening the heart to the Dhamma, opening the heart to nature. And I also, particularly in the latter part of the retreat, I would be, you know, sitting outdoors and sitting on my own in the forest. And I would find it was almost like a kind of game that you could watch, like a sort of, you know, you push a button and you watch the film clip, and you push it again, and you watch the clip, and you push it again, and you watch the clip. And what I find was that my mind would be taken up with some particular feeling or some particular thought or a kind of a mood or whatever. And I would just think the phrase, opening the heart to the Dhamma. And then, even though I hadn't even noticed that there was an I holding on to my feeling or my meditation or my anything, you know, it is totally invisible. But then as soon as I would think the words, opening the heart to the Dhamma, then it's like, oh, how come a veil fell away when I didn't even know there was one there? And there would be immediately a sense of that quality of openness and richness and wholeness, and a sense of homecoming. Uh-huh, look at that. And then, you know, a few moments later, then sort of back with, you know, with the kind of normal flow of experience, and I'd bring up the same phrase or a similar phrase, you know, like, you know, open the heart, opening the heart to the Dhamma, to the way things are. and then there it is again, or there it's not again. And that, and just seeing how simple, just that actually your heart knows what the reality is, and such. And I find this is what works for me. Just these little reminders, even though they're very, very insignificant in themselves, they just coax the heart into recognizing the a deeper level of reality. It's just like brightening, kind of igniting the wisdom light momentarily, so that the wisdom, the light of wisdom, shines through the fog. And that sense of self-concern or self-centeredness, or even just kind of my meditation, my practice, what I'm doing, at that moment that's dropped, that dissolves, and there's just the Dhamma, there's the reality of your own mind knowing the reality of all things. In fact, it's just the Dhamma recognizing its own nature, because the Dhamma, the reality of your mind, is not a different reality from the reality of the field of perceptions and experience. It's just Dhamma recognizing its own nature. On a slightly more, that was very enjoyable. It was a kind of extremely delightful and inspiring kind of insight. Then another insight I had was much more kind of sobering, and it was a kind of flip side of that one, which is it was much more sobering and chastening, which was there was kind of two parts to it, which was firstly I realized there was something in me which was something in me to which it was more important to be thought of as being enlightened than to actually be enlightened. And so as to say, something that was like, well, as long as I'm kind of scoring points and that my mother's proud of me and that and when I die, they'll write sort of memorial volumes of interesting essays and put nice things on a memorial shrine, then I will have succeeded. Whether I've actually kind of made it to any kind of real insight or not, that doesn't matter. As long as people think I did, then my life will not have been wasted. Now, you might think, that's pretty stupid. So, well, I thought it was so too. I thought, that can't really be true, but I began to see there was, I mean, not all of me thought that, but when, say, I would experience praise, or someone would be impressed with something that I said, or someone would, come sometimes kind of write me a letter saying they'd read a book, or this or that, or how they were grateful for the teachings, and so there was something which was that was flattered and just wanted to take refuge in that praise or that approval. That it's like great, I'm okay, or it proved to my mother that I am actually doing something useful. And even though there's a kind of someone is being helped or someone is expressing gratitude, could see there was a very self-centered, vulnerable quality of the consciousness that just wanted to take refuge in that feeling of me the success, or me the person who's been inspiring, or me who's helped someone's life. And whether their projections about me as being a kind of great and wonderful person were true or not, at that moment of a kind of taking hold of the approval, that was utterly insignificant. And I saw that and I thought, wow, this is frightening. And so I'd start to sort of create other images in my mind, like, well, even if I was completely criticized or kind of on one level, on a sort of external level, a complete failure, and nobody ever appreciated anything I did, and I was thought of as a complete sort of schmuck and totally lost and absolutely without any value. And completely misunderstood and misrepresented. If in fact, inside, my heart was completely clear, then that would be great. Then my life would not have been wasted. And it was an interesting contrast, because whereas the other, there's a sort of a sweet taste with a bitter kind of after effect, if you know what I mean. It's like it's sort of initially sweet, but with a kind of bitterness that's left in the mouth. The other was just thinking the thought of like being totally rejected or kind of criticized or ignored or sort of misunderstood. Just even thinking those words, it's like, ooh, you know, that's bitter. But if the fact of was actually, well, you know, inside there's nothing but the free mind, then great. And then, so that had a kind of a bitter foretaste, but a very, very sweet aftertaste. The other part of the the same kind of insight was the recognition that I was, and it's kind of very similar. I would find myself more afraid of being, known to be kind of lazy or to be kind of untogether or to be kind of not practicing well or to be kind of not doing as well as I could in terms of a practice or being a monk or whatever. More afraid of somebody finding out, like, you know, say if we have during a retreat time, we have periods where we have no schedule, so you don't have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning to get to the morning chanting. So I'm a night owl, right? If I have no schedule, then like my day will end at like 1 or 2 in the morning. So I've been waiting for 20 years for 4 a.m. to feel like a reasonable time to get up. It hasn't happened yet. So then, you know, if you stay up to 1 or 2 in the morning, then of course, you know, you don't wake up till like about 6 or 7. But, you know, within our culture, sort of monastic culture, you know, getting up at 6 or 7 in the morning, even though you might have gone to bed at 1, still there's this kind of anxiety that, oh my God, maybe one of the novices is going to come and visit or drop in at 6:30 with a, you know, kindly bringing a flask of tea or something, and there I will be under my duvet. You know, and so like the fear of being kind of found out that, oh my God, Ajahn Amaro is under his duvet at 6:30 in the morning. Can you believe it? You know, and so more worried about being known to be lazy than in fact, you know, actually being lazy. Like, and I began to contemplate this, that there was a big difference between I was far more afraid of being known for not doing the right thing than I was of being afraid or be concerned about not doing the right thing, like being more afraid of being found out than afraid of wrongdoing. If one can use, you know, those kind of phrases. And that was really startling as well. And both of these are sort of reveal aspects of subtle and not so subtle aspects of self, like self-image, wanting to, how I want people to think of me. And I'm just using, I mean, I'm talking about me a lot, but I'm just using my own experience as an example. But it's interesting that it's taken 20 years of meditation to really kind of coax this kind of stuff out of the dark, to really see, like, oh, look at that, there's a lot of pride there. I never really never really noticed that before. Ah, isn't that interesting? And it's kind of painful to see, but then also, like, you know, the painful of pain of a rotten tooth being pulled out. It's like, it's painful, but it's kind of relieving as well to actually see that. And also, when we let go, or when we see that kind of subtle attachments to self and trying to take refuge in self, when we actually see what we're doing, and in that moment of kind of breaking it, like thinking the unthinkable, like, oh, Tansudanta is going to come to my kuti and find me under the duvet at 6:30. And then what? He'll just say, good morning, Ajahn. Sorry to disturb you. That's all. No big deal, you know. No big deal. And so that when we stop trying to create or take refuge in the feeling of self, then we let go of that, then what do we experience except peace? There's a relief, because we've been trying to take refuge in that which is not dependable, in that which is fragile, in that which is kind of fabricated. And so in that moment of recognition of, like, the habit of taking refuge in self, in I and me and mine, then in that moment, then in that release, then we find that quality of wholeness. We take refuge in the Sangha, in the Dhamma, in the Buddha. There's that recognition of our say belonging to the universe, belonging to all beings. That is really the experience of a Kalyana, of the beautiful. At that moment, we recognize the heart is beautiful. Even though there might be the kind of things are not the way we would choose them to be, there might be some kind of painful quality there. That very recognition of, oh, this is just the Dhamma, this is just the way things are, this is just the nature of things. That is the great sweetness. That's the great beauty of life. And whether it fits a particular image of how we wanted things to be, or of how we want ourselves to be, or how we want ourselves to be seen, then we realize, well, what does that matter? You know, sometimes it goes this way, sometimes it goes that way. You know, sometimes you sit down to meditate and you're there with your friends and everything is kind of beautiful and peaceful. Sometimes your cell phone goes off and you think, no! And then, you know, you're kind of, you collapse in a kind of pool of embarrassment. And it's kind of, how could I be so stupid? Why is it me? Oh, what are people going to think about me? That guy with the cell phone. You know. So then we can say, well, somebody's cell phone's got to go off, so why shouldn't it be mine? You know. Good that it was me, then it was somebody else's, you know. If her cell phone had gone off, then she would feel really terrible. So, you know, maybe I can just sort of be glad to take the rap. I can be the one that this happened to. Fine. So there's a wholeness there. And in that kind of simple opening, that simple kind of, that gesture of saying, you know, it's fine for me to get it wrong. It's fine for me to get it right. This is the way life is. We find ourselves able to appreciate others and to really accord with others, to empathize with others, with their beauty, with their ugliness, with all of their qualities. There's a profound empathizing at the deepest level that we don't see a kind of intrinsic separateness. We feel the unity. A kind of the empathy is not two beings harmonizing with each other, but more like one being. It's the different attributes of the same the same being, the same reality. So I will offer these thoughts for your reflection this evening. Please take what is useful. So we have time for a question or two, if people would like, before we close for the evening. Well, it's a very simple reason. Weather, yeah. Because in Southeast Asia, the monsoon is between July and October, and then at that time, it's very difficult to travel. All the roads are muddy and so forth. So it's the ideal time of the year for retreat. You can't do any outdoor work in the monasteries. You know, it's just so rainy. So the thing to do is just to kind of batten down the hatches and meditate. And then the other time of the year, particularly the winter, is the ideal time for going wandering. And it's also dry, it's cool. For doing building work around the place and repairs, it's also ideal at that time. So that the same values in the West, you get the summertime is when the weather is best, and then also you have school and university holidays. Everyone's got free time. People are getting time off work. It's the best time for doing building work. And then the winter is kind of rainy and cold, and so that it's the obvious time to sort of shut down and be indoors and meditate. Well, there's sets of rules and observances that go along with the official rains retreat. So the one in the summer, when it's kind of blue skies every day for 3 months, is a sort of rains retreat, inverted commas. So we had thought a number of years ago of actually sort of officially transferring it to the winter, but there were so many sort of political riders on that, it was so difficult that we eventually decided what we do is technically keep the one in the summer and then have the real community retreat in the winter. So what happens in the summer is that we use that as a time for individual retreat. So say you've got a dozen people in the monastery, then for each 2 week period, then a couple of people will go off and do solitary retreat. And so they're outside of the whole routine of the monastery. If they want to eat, they show up with their bowl. But they have no duties, and they don't have to do any work around the place. They're kind of living in complete seclusion. Then after that 2 weeks, then another couple of people go off. And then also during that whole time, then we usually have a lot of study of the monastic discipline and various teachings. So it's a more of a time for instruction of the community in discipline, and then also individual retreat, so that there is something of the element of a retreat period focus, a practice period, but it's not the same as the winter, where it's like, okay, we no external engagements, no overnight visitors, and we all keep the same routine for the 3 months. Yeah, same. we just copied it from there. Yeah.
Yeah. So here you found out that you spoke of. Would you ever consider using that as a useful way of saying emphasis to living a right way?
Right.
Almost as an external way of controlling my
actions. Yeah. Yeah, it's been... Yeah. I mean, one of the reasons is so that you carry your reminder with you. And, you know, you can do it in many different ways. I mean, all sorts of different religious traditions have their different forms. And this is the one of the, you know, Buddhist traditional forms, Theravada monastic style. But that's exactly it. It's kind of reminding you of your intentions.
There's two sides, of course, and I think you mentioned them here in the talk. There's the reminder of the intention, and there's the fear of being seen.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really questioning myself and asking more about the second part.
Well, there's this interesting quality. I mean, we're very it's very difficult for us in the West to be clear about things like shame and guilt. And there's this really interesting quality that the Buddha spoke of called Hiriyotapa, which he called the guardian of the world, which is like, in that respect, sort of the human world in particular. And the guardian, Hiriyotapa, literally means it has two parts. It's like a recoiling from the unwholesome, right? And it means a healthy fear of consequences, or a sense of conscience, if you like. And so that, and oftentimes it's translated as a sense of shame. But in the West, you know, shame has got a bad name. It's like it's something that you don't want to have around. And so that what happens is that you end up being shameless. You know, which is another word that's kind of got derogatory connotations. So you might think, well, if I do certain things and then I feel bad about it afterwards, then I've got this neurotic problem. So if I have enough therapy, or if I get it right, I can just do whatever I want to do and not feel bad about it. Right? And you can, $20,000 of therapy, and you should be able to get, you know, pull it off. I'm being derogatory. Okay, but, you know, that's, we can approach it in that way. It's like, if I really had it together, then I wouldn't feel bad about acting in this way. I should just be able to kind of be myself and not feel bad about it. But the Buddhist approach is that, well, sometimes you feel bad about things that you should feel bad about. You know, it's appropriate that you feel bad about it, because it's like, and what it's compared to is like that sense of Hiriyotapa is like physical pain. It's like a moral pain, because human beings we have an innate moral sense, which means that if you harm another being, it hurts you. There's an innate morality, like I was talking about in terms of our sort of connectedness. You know, if you're, the more thick-skinned you are, the less you'll notice that. The more kind of numb, you know, the more anesthetic you've kind of got in the system, the less you'll feel it. But intrinsically, there is a painfulness. When you tell a lie, then it hurts. It's painful. There's fear. There's tension that comes from that. So that painfulness is exactly like the physical pain that we experience. Pain is not a problem. Pain is nature's most basic device for keeping us protected. If it hurts, it means don't do it again, or keep away from it. You know, if I bash my hand, ouch, it hurts. Like, so if I keep doing that, then I'm going to damage myself. So that the pain stops us from, keeps us away from dangerous situations, from physical harm. So, you know, there's a rare physical condition where people experience no pain. It's a kind of, they're born with no pain senses. They don't, as I understand it, they don't usually live beyond their early 20s. Because their bodies are so smashed up from the numerous injuries, broken bones and unset joints and that the body is actually in shock constantly, and so they die by their early 20s. So that pain is a protection. It's not pleasant, but it protects us. So similarly, hiriyotapa, like a moral sensitivity, is painful. Like if I tell you a lie, if I deceive you, or if I hurt you, if I take something that belongs to you, then that's painful because it's protecting my heart. It's like so that it's nature's way of telling you, you just went against the natural order. You just put me first at the detriment of another, and that pain is the signal that we've just kind of lost it. So it's very difficult for us to see that is actually something beautiful and good, because there's a line where that is something that's helpful. As soon as the ego grabs hold of it and says, "Oh, I'm no good. I'm so stupid. I'm such a creep. I can't," then it's become guilt. And it's become unhealthy. But the feeling of that kind of painfulness itself, hiriyotapa, there's no ego involved in it. There's no I. Just as you know, by bashing the fingers on the wood, there's no I involved in that. It's just a natural connection, a natural reaction. So that being able to experience that painfulness and recognize, oh, here's a signal, you know, don't do that again. It's not a neurotic problem. Feeling bad about yourself if you tell lies, it's not a neurotic problem. It's a sign of good spiritual health. And in Buddhist tradition, it's like a spiritually mature person will experience a lot of hiriyotapa. You have a very highly developed sense of conscience. So that you can't even, it's impossible for you to kill an ant without feeling terrible about it. If it turns into a kind of big ego thing, then, oh my god, I'm this terrible criminal, I can't, you know, you can't sleep for a week because you killed an ant. Then it's turned into a neurotic problem. But in itself, that kind of profound respect for life, so that you couldn't deliberately kill an ant without feeling immense pain, means that there's a great deal of spiritual maturity there. Okay, one last one.
When is it appropriate to feel anger?
Well, feeling it or following it. Well, it arises kind of unbidden, so it's appropriate to feel it whenever it arises. But it's never appropriate to... the way I understand or use the word anger, if you follow it, it will always have a painful result. But being angry is not the same as being fierce. You can be fierce with no anger in it. So you can look frightening and talk in a loud voice and actually have with your heart completely cool. But if there is real anger there, then there's intrinsically an agitation. There's the desire to harm or to hurt, to destroy, which is completely self-based. And that has to have a negative result. So being fierce without being angry is an art form. But it can be done. You really have to be, you have to know yourself very, very well to do that. It's like, you know, when one of your kids is about to, like Drake is about to, you know, run off a cliff, you know, you might yell at him, right? Just to catch his attention. Because if you don't, it's like over he goes, right? So that you yell, and with a, not because you're annoyed with him, but because you want to preserve his life. So in that same way, you know, you can be fierce or you can be intense, but with no negativity. But as long as the degree to which there's real negativity there, then there will be painful results, unnecessarily.
And I noticed that I, in the process of yelling, often became angry or had some manifestation of anger, which wasn't really my intention.
Right.
There's some tag along I found.
Yeah, it's really difficult to do. It's one of life's harder tricks to pull off. Also because even though you know that there's nothing going on inside you, the person who's on the receiving end might definitely believe that you're angry and interpret it in that way. So you have to really, really, really know your stuff to also receive their projections of resentment and so on, as well as being sure there's nothing going on inside you. But some, you know, it can be done, and it can be and have no negative result within you, and can be the most helpful thing in a situation. I think it's about time to finish for the evening. So we'll close with the sharing of blessings, which is page 21. Now let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration through the goodness that arises from my practice. May my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless through the goodness that arises from my practice. And through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nibbana in every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma.
The solitary Buddha is my noble Lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and illusion be dispelled. Patipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho, the Blessed One's disciples who have practiced well, Sangham Namami, I bow to the Sangha. That's all for this evening. Next weekend, on the 9th, there's the day long at Spirit Rock. I think, is that the Saturday or the Sunday? Sunday. And then at the end of the month, there was a celebration of Buddha Day going to be happening at Stanford University, but that has been cancelled, as I understand. But I will be leading a session with Gil Fronsdal's group down in the Palo Alto area on Sunday morning, April 30th. So that might actually turn into a whole day long, because I was going to do the morning with Gil and then do the afternoon with the Buddha Day. But since the Buddha Day thing is evaporated, it might yet manifest into a whole day long there, but I have to figure that out with Gil. So that's April 30th, and otherwise there'll be the Monday at the beginning of the month, or Tuesday at the beginning of the month in May. Any other announcements?
Just to say in general, there are books and newsletters and literature in the back about the monastery. Novel that I don't know if you can read it yet. Also, we have a group that meets every Tuesday, besides Tuesday, we have a chanting, sitting in, drawing a discussion amongst ourselves. We've been meeting at the Thai Temple on Russell Street, and we have a new location beginning next Tuesday. We'll be meeting at the Berkeley Zen Center, which is also on Russell Street. For anybody who feels inspired, there's a small basket in the
One last thing. There's some transcription work of some Dharma talks, about 10 Dharma talks. That if anyone's interested in doing transcription work, I will be happy to hear from you. So just come up and let me know afterwards. Go well.